What's up?
Normally have a chairman open the meeting for the chairman's sake, and for the chairman's sake we have a vice chairman open the meeting, but he's over in Europe. And it goes on down the line, and about 20th of the line is the program chairman. That's me. And so I'm opening the meeting tonight. We've had a rather successful season so far this year. We had 160 people turn out at CompSat last month. And that was our first meeting. This is our second. Our next meeting is in December. It's going to be a tour of WTOP TV, with some very interesting things to be seen on that tour. Our January meeting, we're hoping to arrange a tour of Dulles International Airport and have dinner out there, and split up then, so the power people can go see the mobile lounges, and the electronic communication people can go see the communication systems, and I'm going to go out there and find out just how many ways we can split up, because it's better if you have smaller groups. Our February meeting is scheduled to be sponsored by the Electron Devices Group, and it's going to be a lecture and demonstration of information theory as applied to night vision devices. Beyond that, we still remain open. We're trying to have something interesting every year because the people come to the tour. They like to see something and really be there where there's something educational to see. I was just talking to George Abraham, and I understand that a week ago he got notice that he was elected a regional director. Is that right, George? Congratulations, he's taking Del Reports' place, who is also here, and will be through at the end of this year. Well, as host too, we thank you, Del, for your good work. The meeting tonight is sponsored by the Engineering Management Group, and to introduce things, here's Frank Mitchell.
Thank you, Bob. I'd like to, as chairman of the Engineering Management Group, I'd like to extend our appreciation to Atlantic Research for letting us use these very fine facilities, and I would also like to say that you gentlemen who didn't join in the dinner tonight missed a real good meal. I hope that we can do this again sometime, but in appreciation to our host, I'd like you to meet Dr. Rayfield, who is the president of Atlantic Research. Would you say just a word, Doctor?
On behalf of Atlantic Research, very pleased to welcome you to our EdSol facility. I have been with Atlantic Research now for about 2 months, and one of my goals, one of my objectives, is to make the operation known to many people, to those people who don't know about it. Here I have a captive group, and I thought I'd like to just take 1 minute and commercialize. I'm not going to talk about rockets or a Jansky and Bailey TV broadcast or missiles. I don't know how much you know about Atlantic Research and apples, but you eat apples right now. This is a real good season for eating apples. And they're selling them on all the roadside stands, and then December will come along and they'll sort of slow down, and by January you won't be able to get them anymore. When you eat your apples in February, you will be eating apples which have been frozen, and freezing extends the life into February and a little bit into March, but it doesn't taste very good at that point. And then late March and April comes along, and at that point the only apples you can get are those that have been extended into the April, May, June period, because they have been kept in silos where there was no oxygen, or in storage areas where the oxygen was removed with special chambers which we build. So if you eat any apples in May or June and you enjoy them and they taste good, please think of Atlantic Research. That's the end of the commercial.
Looks like everybody's giving a commercial around here tonight. Bob got up and gave his. Let me give one. Coming meetings of the Engineering Management Group. December 1 will be a workshop, a dinner meeting, held in, at the Emerson's restaurant. And to all the members of the Engineering Management Group who haven't sent in their reservations, it still isn't too late. So I was just talking to the secretary, and she said that she'd be very happy to accept reservations through tomorrow. January 5th is a Tuesday luncheon meeting at Blackie's, 12 noon. We're going to have Marv Setron who's going to speak on technological forecasting techniques, a very interesting subject to engineering managers. February 2nd, another Tuesday luncheon meeting at Blackie's, Dr. Alan Aston, and the title in his talk, Reflections for Engineering Managers, which should be a very interesting talk. So much for the commercials. First, before we get into the meeting, I would like to extend my real deep appreciation to the guys that have worked so hard on this program. And the first guy that comes to mind is Jack Carter, who has just put in hours after hours. I don't see Jack. Where the heck is he? I'd like him to stand up and just say thanks, Jack, for everything you've done. Jim Hill is back here in the booth, and he's still trying to figure that audio system out, but he promises that we're going to have a tape on this show, and he's been working for several weeks. And last, Del Ports, who has given us a lot of advice and information on putting this program together. We thank you too, Del. Now the program this evening, and we promised Atlantic Research we'd get out of here by 9:30, quarter to 10. We don't know how long it'll run, but I'm going to leave it up to Jim, who is the moderator of this panel discussion on IEEE in the 70s, a technical society or professional association. So at this time, let me introduce the panel, and then I will turn it over to Jim Mulligan. Each one of the panel will have a few minutes in which they will just make a short discussion, then it will be a discussion period from the floor. So the first one is Jim Mulligan, who is Executive Secretary or Moderator, Executive Secretary of the National Academy of Engineering, a nominee for the President of the IEEE in 1971. Representing the federal government, we have Eric Ward, who is with the Federal Council for Science and Technology as Executive Secretary and Technical Assistant to the President's Science Advisor. Eric? Representing the Engineering Union, Harold Ammon, Executive Secretary of the Association of Scientists and Professional Engineering Personnel. Representing the Legal Professionals Association, Don Channel. Don is the Director of the Washington Office of the American Bar Association. Last but not least, Trevor Clark, representing management. Trevor is the manager of the Information Systems of the Aerospace and Electronic Systems Division, Westinghouse Electric Corporation. The meeting's yours.
Thank you very much, Frank. First, let me take a moment or two to bring you greetings from John Granger, the present president of IEEE, and say that I'm very pleased to be here and involved in this meeting. And let me also add my congratulations to George Abraham and tell you something that you may not know, and that is that poor George has already been hard at work. He attended meetings last week, which went all day Saturday, all day Sunday, and he had a break on Monday, and he was at work all day Tuesday and Wednesday. And although you may think that Delmer Ports is free and clear from the announcement that you heard that George has been elected, you should also know that Delmer Ports has been asked to serve as chairman of the Finance Committee of the Regional Activities Board, which is made up of the regional directors, and he'll be hard at work for at least another year on a pretty important area, namely the finances. With that as background, let me just say a word or two of introduction, and that is that the subject that we're discussing tonight is one that is very important to the officers and the members of the Board of Directors of IEEE. This is one reason I'm very pleased to be here, to learn at first hand what the reactions of the individual members are. I should say by way of background that I've attended a number of these meetings, and I'm very interested to see what the flavor of the comments is in the Washington, D.C. area. I think that the principal contribution tonight will be the opportunity to exchange ideas with the members of the panel, and for that reason, I view their comments as, in effect, an introduction and a stimulus to you, members of our audience, and I hope that you'll be loaded with questions so that when they finish, we can have a good discussion. In the interests of being fair to each of the speakers, I thought that we'd proceed with all of their comments first, and then we'll open the meeting for discussion rather than having questions to each speaker. As you well know, you can get pretty interested in what the first speaker says, and the time just runs away from you, and the other three just never seem to get much time to state their views. We're going to start with Mr. Harold J. Ammond, and in the announcement of the meeting, he said to represent the engineering union. I think that perhaps a more accurate description would be that his task is to present some information to us concerning the operation of a typical association. And his association, as you know, is the Association of Scientists and Professional Engineering Personnel. Mr. Ammon.
Thank you, Doctor. Each speaker has been asked to briefly outline the organization that he represents. The organization I represent is a labor union representing the research and development engineers of the RCA Corporation in the greater Camden area. We have some 1,200 research, development, and design engineers in what we would call the bargaining unit. These are non-supervisory engineers. A supervisor, under the terms of the National Labor Relations Act, would be an individual who has the right of hire and fire. Within the RCA structure, this comes in at the leader level. This is a man who might have anywhere from 2 to 20 engineers working for him under his direction. He would work under a manager. The net result is the description then of the bargaining unit, it would be all research, development, and design engineers employed by RCA in the Camden area. The association was formed 25 years ago, and in effect it was formed so that the professional unit would not become part of a blue-collar union that was organizing at RCA at the time. This background is quite typical of the more than 100,000 engineers in the United States that are represented by independent organizations. This is true of the Boeing organization out in Seattle, McDonnell Douglas, Lockheed, a number of the Westinghouse organizations. There are also similar organizations to ours in Canada. The net result is then we are not necessarily unique. We are unique within the labor community because, one, we are not AFL-CIO. We are independently operated by the engineers at RCA. This, of course, would be true of the individuals at Boeing, Lockheed, Douglas, Westinghouse, and the other organizations that are certified collective bargaining units. In this country, we have two forms. We have the certified, that is an organization that has been certified under the existing laws to represent the interest of the community that it purports to represent. There are organizations primarily found in two companies in the United States, in GE and Bell Laboratories, where the engineering community has formed what is called a sounding board. This is a non-certified organization that does not have the right to communicate directly with management, but does so by publications and other means other than direct certification. Thus, in the United States, we have two types of organizations, certified and sounding board. We are a certified collective bargaining agent, which means that we have the legal power to, in effect, negotiate for the interest of the professional engineers at RCA. We have done so now 18 times. The contract has been renegotiated 18 times during the past 25 years. We have just concluded another successful negotiations with RCA, and the contract was ratified on October 5th by 96% of our voting members. In looking at the topic, IEEE, technical society or professional, as an organization, our organization encourages all of its members to become part of and members of and participants in the technical societies which truly represent their interest in engineering. Thus, as far as our organization is concerned, we see no conflict between membership in IEEE, ASME, or whatever technical society an individual would be a member of, and his membership in our union. Looking at IEEE, I would make the observation that it is a technical society. There are possibly some areas. For instance, let me just briefly say this to you. 1968, our organization sponsored a meeting in Florida to bring together all of the organizations representing, through the process of collective bargaining and sounding boards, to create an organization which we now call the Council of Engineers and Scientist Organizations. This is now has a membership of some 125,000 members. Its basic objective is to try to bring to the attention of legislators problems which we cannot settle on a local level between ourselves and RCA. For instance, there are many things that we cannot resolve with the company. For instance, the problem of portable pensions, which is so pressing today in the engineering community, can never be resolved between RCA and ACEPET. It's a national problem. Thus, we need a national voice. I would say to you, I would think IEEE might consider action on a lobbying program in behalf of the entire engineering community, not necessarily only the members of IEEE, because there is much that you could do in the retirement area, in the pension area, patents, foreign competition. However, to be very candid with you, IEEE to involve itself on the local level of employer-employee relations, I doubt very much if IEEE is geared for this type of operation either now or any time in the future. So I think our roles are separate. We serve different objectives. I think there is a certain area where organizations like IEEE, ASME, or any of the other professional groups can join together for the good and welfare of the entire engineering community at large. And I hope that will stimulate some questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ammon. Next we'll have Mr. Donald B. Chanel,
who is the director of the Washington Office of the American Bar Association, to speak on how that organization operates.
Thank you. We have an organization, it's a voluntary membership organization of approximately 148,000 members. The way the legal profession is organized is that normally a lawyer belongs to the Bar Association of the city in which he belongs, in which he practices. He also normally belongs to his state Bar Association. And then over half of them, or about half of them, belong to the National or the American Bar Association. About two-thirds of our members are practicing attorneys, meaning being in the private practice. Therefore, they're normally self-employed individuals. This is probably where we differ to some extent with IEEE, in that the minority of our members are corporate employees or government employees. We have sections within the American Bar Association which is not comparable to your term sections, but I think more comparable to your term of groups, in which they deal in specialized fields of the law, whether it be patent law, banking law, taxation, real property, and so forth. There's 20 of those sections, and a member of the American Bar, in addition to joining the association, most of the members join one or more sections to in order to receive publications in that specialized field, or to serve on committees and attend meetings and institutes in that specialized area. The policy-making body of the association is the House of Delegates, which is about 275 members, which meets twice a year. It's composed of delegates from state bar associations, from major city bar associations, depending on the number of members, and from various other ways of electing delegates. A state delegate, for example, from every state is elected by a mail ballot of the ABA members in that state. We have, staff-wise, a staff in Chicago over 200 people. We have a public service division, which concerns itself with the broader scope of things of interest to lawyers which do not directly affect their practice or their economics. Broad public policy, whether it be criminal law, court reform, that type of thing. Then we have a division on legal education and practice, and this concerns itself with helping the lawyer as a lawyer keep up with what's going on in the profession and in the law, and economically it bears more on his direct practice. And then my function here in Washington is to substantial extent carrying on a legislative program and acting as liaison between the association and the federal government on matters of concern to us. We lobby for on positions which we have established through our House of Delegates. And the scope of the lobbying is very broad because, as you can imagine, the legal profession is interested in a great deal of matters. I might say that the major part of our legislative program is basically a public interest type of lobby. It gives us a little better reception maybe over on the Hill, but I mean this by, if we're lobbying for court reform legislation, of course the lawyers are interested in court reform, but that doesn't mean it's putting any more dollars in the lawyers' pockets, or if it's crime legislation, or those kind of matters. Now, we do have legislative matters of direct interest to the lawyer as a practicing lawyer. For example, Harold mentioned the pension plan field. We've corporate employees have enjoyed the opportunity to participate in pension plans for many years before the World War II, in which the contributions to that plan made on behalf of the employee by the corporation is not taxable to the employee until he draws it down later. The self-employed professional individual did not enjoy that same type of opportunity. So if he wanted to retire, set up a retirement plan, he had to pay taxes first on the amount of money that he earned and whatever he had left to put into the plan, and then he had to pay taxes on the earnings. And the difference is tremendous over a 25-30-year span. Now, we did lobby for several years to correct that obvious inequity in the law. We cooperated with other professional organizations in the same situation that we were. We finally got some legislation through, and it's been amended once. It needs to be amended again. That area of pension planning is something that I would imagine the Treasury Department is going to come up with a proposal in the pension field, and I'm sure that everyone will be looking at that tax proposal. Basically, I think that that's an outline of our structure.
Thank you very much, Tony. Now, from the viewpoint of one who's in management, we'll look at the question of the Technical Society or Professional Association as far as IEEE's future is concerned. And to do that, we have Trevor Clark. Trevor?
Well, I don't propose to go into any structure of management this evening. That's the title of another lecture that I give periodically. But what I want to do is to examine just two aspects of the relationship of the Technical Society to the organizations which are doing the hiring of engineers, and also perhaps from the standpoint of the professional engineers who are in business for themselves. Nearly every organization which does hire professional people expects those professional people to support the society which supports their discipline. In other words, if they are hiring civil engineers, they would expect their civil engineers to belong to the Civil Engineering Society, to be active in that society, to be active on the committees, on the local level, and on the national level. And in general, the position that one gets in an organization can almost be related directly to the technical prestige which he holds within the discipline, within the organization supporting that discipline, which he in turn supports. It is very often necessary to consider an applicant for a job, or to consider a man who is improving himself through self-education and while he is working, to consider whether or not he should be made a professional. And there are laws which describe when a man is a professional and when he is not. And one of the things that is always looked at is, does the man belong to the technical society which represents his discipline, or has he been active on the local committees or in the national activities of that society? Is he truly a technical man who is concerned with the disciplines that he represents? A man who has not attained a degree can still become, can still attain the title of engineer in most organizations if he has proved by contributions to the technology that he represents, either by publication in the technical journals or by obtaining patents in his field or by presenting papers to the technical societies that represent him. He can usually become a professional much more easily than if he does not participate in these societies. Now, in this way, the societies perform a very useful function because they in turn pass upon the technical accomplishments of these people who submit papers for publication. And if any of you have ever tried to have a paper published in the technical journal of your choice, you will know that it is subjected to a considerable amount of editorial scrutiny. In addition, if you wish to give a paper before a technical society, you, your previous accomplishments, the abstract which you submit, are generally screened pretty carefully before you are put on the program. So the technical society, and this has been true for centuries, not just recently, the technical society performs a very useful purpose as a technical forum for its members, as a referee, a jury of peers for the technical accomplishments of those who wish to speak on the technology of that discipline. Now, the second point, I have been associated with the Institute of Radio Engineers and later the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers for a considerable number of years, and I've gone through some of the pains that have been associated with the organization as it has grown. The nonprofit status which the Institute presently enjoys is a very precious thing. It is something which very rightly the Board of Directors protects with all of their skill and with all of their force. If that nonprofit status is ever lost, it probably never could be regained. It is something that is peculiar to the United States of America. It is not available to any organizations, whether it's secular, professional, technical, or otherwise, in any other country that I know. It is a very powerful thing, and I do not believe that the members of the Institute would be wise in asking that any aspect of that be jeopardized, because it is in considerable jeopardy. It is under constant scrutiny and constant attack by the federal government, the Internal Revenue Service, the state government, the city governments, just simply for the purpose of collecting taxes from it. It's a very precious thing. I think that is something that we should guard very carefully.
Thank you very much, Trevor. Our last panel speaker is Eric Ward, who holds a couple of positions over in Ed David's shop. He's Executive Secretary of the Federal Council for Science and Technology, and he is also a technical assistant to the President's Science Advisor, who, as you know, is Dr. David. Eric Ward.
I think I'd like to approach this subject a little bit differently. I don't really want to tell you how the government's organized for science and technology, but let me simply say that the President's Science Advisor has a number of duties. First of all, he is appointed by the President as his advisor. And secondly, he heads the Office of Science and Technology, which is a position legislated into being for which he needs Senate confirmation. the same individual has always held both of these positions, so we don't really make much of a distinction between them, but you in fact could. The head of the Office of Science and Technology could be a different individual from the present science advisor. Science advisor chairs two fairly well-known committees. One is the President's Science Advisory Council, PSAC, made up of non-government scientists, 18 of them. They meet 2 or 3 days a month. And the second group is the Federal Council for Science and Technology, made up of all government employees, the top scientists from each federal agency, and they meet normally once a month. So those two bodies are both chaired by the President's Science Advisor. I think the point of view I'd like to take in this discussion, though, is essentially this, that if the society, if the members of the society really want to influence what happens to them in the future, they, either individually or through that society, must become more involved in the political process. And whether they do it through the society or as individuals, I'm really not qualified to make that judgment, but I can make this judgment. But if a typical decision in the federal government ought to have some percentage of it made, the impact on it ought to be, in some percentage, dictated by science and technology. And if we simply said that a typical decision, you take 100 points and you allocate it to the decision, some number of those ought to be made because of science and technology. Whatever number that is intrinsically right for that, in fact, probably less than that number really are made because the scientists are really not very much involved at the decision-making levels in the political process. So I feel strongly that that representation should be increased. And I'm not sure whether the IEEE is the right way to do it, but I think it ought to be done in some manner. And I've got some other ideas on how one might do this, but I think from the questions you may ask, we may get a little bit better framework and stimulate some of your thinking as individuals on what you might do. And I just ask the question kind of this way, just throw out to you some ideas. How many of you contributed to political campaigns in the last election? How many of you really went out and rang doorbells for a candidate? How many of you want your kids to run for political office? And let's proceed from that kind of framework.
Okay, you've heard these comments and you have just recently had a few questions tossed at you.
Speak into the mic.
Excuse me, thought you could hear me without the mic. You've heard these comments and you've heard a couple of questions from Eric Ward. Who'd like to ask a question in the audience? Bob?
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Ward, I hear you saying that in order to influence Congress and the government in the laws that are passed, we almost have to be a lobby group. Doesn't the Congress have some obligation to come to the professional societies when they pass legislation that would affect our research and development and our future stability and the position in the world of our country? Shouldn't they call in the American Physical Society and the IEEE and get inputs from us? Or is the only way for them to know that we exist and that we have an interest is to have a paid lobby group here in Washington to bring the message forward?
Well, without answering your question personally, I think it's exactly that attitude that causes the problem. Because they're human beings just like anybody else, and if you want to sell them something, that's just the way you don't do it. And that attitude, and I've watched lots of testimony and written a fair amount myself, is just what you don't do. Because Joe Congress was sitting up there and say, all you smart guys, you got us to the moon and you can't solve our social problems, to hell with you. And then you get up and testify and say, you ought to come to our professional societies and get our advice. They say, nuts. You guys have not the vaguest idea how the process works. You don't understand what politics is. Why should we ask you? Now, what you really ought to do is you ought to go to those congressmen and say, look, Charlie, if you take this problem and handle it this way, I'll get you some more votes. And then he says, yeah, yeah.
Eric, question in the back.
I'd like to underline what this gentleman just said. In fact, before we go to the Congress, we ought to go to the IEEE. They are the ones that wouldn't know democracy if they fell over it from public back. This gentleman from Westinghouse has given us the official IEEE, and he's absolutely correct. It's an honors association. They give honors from the top down. They are not interested from the bottom up. But unfortunately, the IEEE membership senses that there could be something we can do with the IEEE. Before you think I'm completely anti-IEEE, I want to thank Mr. Mulligan for showing up and Dr. Mulligan for showing up, because this is the freshest breath of air we've had in 25 years I've been with the IEEE.
Thank you for your kind comment. Let me just say, before recognizing this other speaker, that George Abraham, who attended these board meetings last week and Delm reports, know that the IEEE officers and the members of the Regional Activities Board, which constitutes the regional directors, are very much interested in what the individual member thinks and believes. Let me just tell you a couple of things that Delm Reports has done, which incidentally have been done in other regions of the country. Delmer has held 3 workshops for the section chairman in Region 2 within this last year, and about 3/4 of the section chairman from Region 2 attended. And these were sessions that were typically all day or all day in the preceding evening. At that time, the problems of the members were discussed. Considerable attention was given to ways in which we might get more information from the members concerning what their needs are, their specific needs today as well as in the future. I myself have visited 8 of the 10 regions. There are 6 in the United States, the 7th is Canada, and the 8th is Europe. I've visited all of these this year and met with the section chairman at regional meetings, have tried to emphasize the responsibility of the section chairman in finding out what his members, what the members in his section want, have emphasized the importance of being familiar as a section officer with what the resources of the institute are and trying to bring these to the individual member. Now, I appreciate your kind comment about my being here. Frankly, my philosophy is that the only way you can find out what the individual member wants, the only way I can find out, is to come out and listen to what he says. There was a man, I guess it's Bill Miller, sitting over here on my right, who heard me speak to a group in Boston at the NERA meeting, which I think was about a week ago. I've kind of lost track of time. And there were some, 200 or 300 members there, and after a few introductory remarks by me, they didn't hesitate to tell me what they thought of the Institute. So I assure you, we're very much interested in what the member thinks, and there are no fixed positions, believe me. We're working very hard to find out what our position should be to respond to the members. Now there was a question up here.
Well, I'm not sure I would like to use as strong a language as my predecessor did, because I think it's mostly our own fault that the IEEE does not possibly resent us as much as we'd like to. But I would like to say that I just got my spectrum a couple of days ago, sort of scanned through some of the articles. And I'm sorry to say that the brief article written by Mr. Granger is one of the most negative articles I've read in a long, long time. It really just a list of excuses why the IEEE shouldn't do a thing in the socioeconomic area. There's not a single positive, active thought in that article that I could really say, good, we're doing something. I'm not sure the IEEE really, by itself, should get into the socioeconomic area. Maybe there are other alternatives that should look into it. But it certainly should take a more positive attitude than look at other alternatives than just say, well, we really don't want to get into this business because we're strictly a technical society. Right now, the economic conditions are such that I think many engineers would much rather see the president's time taken up in doing something constructive on the affordable pension plan than coming up with another bigger and better international convention. One alternative I would like to suggest for discussion here, something I read not too long ago in Machine Design, and editorial, which discussed an approach that was taken in England, namely where the societies like the IEEE, and they quote the Royal Institution of Naval Architects and Institution of Mechanical Engineers, have organized a separate professional organization, sort of sponsored and organized it, and then it's working on its own. So that possibly may be an approach to overcome the next problem of Texas Instruments Foundation. But this organization is open to all engineers and to work under, it's not a collective bargaining unit. Now that's a different aspect. But it is an organization which is primarily primary interest is socioeconomic. That is something that we might consider.
Well, let me make an observation that may be comforting to you, maybe it won't, and that is that, John Granger's article was written necessarily a couple of months ago, and it was based upon action at the August meeting of the Board of Directors. Since that time, things have moved very rapidly. Among other things, I appointed a task force to look into these problems, which can be classed, if you will, as socioeconomic. I asked this task force to give me some recommendations as rapidly as possible, and I received the report last Saturday. Oh, it was a week ago Saturday. And one of the recommendations is the creation of an organization of the kind that you mentioned, a separate professional organization. Now, I'm not making a statement to you or a commitment to you that this is the route in which we should go in the IEEE. But it may be of interest to you to know that we are actively identifying alternatives which might be responsive to various aspects of the members' desires at the moment. I think a very important consideration in considering these alternatives is to be responsible. That is to say, we mustn't hold out an alternative and say, oh, look, we'll open a Washington office, unless we feel that that Washington office will be staffed adequately and supported financially so that it can do some good. In other words, one must avoid being a charlatan in this situation. We're not looking for a Band-Aid on a situation which, in fact, requires a lot more. But this is additional information that you couldn't possibly have, and I thought you might be interested in hearing it. Yes?
I think we've not gotten down to really examining possible alternatives here so far tonight. If I can make my point first by rephrasing, if I may, the issue, I think what we're concerned with here is professionalism of one kind, which you might term technical professionalism, which is the kind that Mr. Clark's speech centered around, as opposed to what you might call a civic professionalism, which was more the topic of our union gentleman from RCA. And I believe that what we're really concerned with is whether or not these two kinds of professionalism in fact need to be put together in one organization to really be effective. Now, when you examine this broadly, I think you can see that they have in them the necessity for exercising different kinds of approaches. The technical versus the civic or professional, which is more alive with the political aspects of the game, and the technical, which is more alive with the elements and fundamentals of the business, are in effect easily polarized. And probably that is the reason we have the situation that we're examining here tonight. Now, there are many organizations of both kinds already in existence. And as it has been pointed out already, IEEE has very little experience in what I've labeled the civic professionalism type of thing. Now, as one alternative, we might discuss the possibility of merging, if we do in fact want something closely allied with IEEE, in order to get in a very short time the expertise that we need in the IEEE to do this kind of job. Now, I'm not advocating that as something which may be desirable, but something which should be examined. I myself belong to the Maryland Society and the National Society of Professional Engineers, which is the organization of registered professional engineers, those who are registered by the individual state. These engineers are probably mostly those who run their own private consulting businesses, but many of them are industry-employed engineers as well. So if you may, I would like to suggest that we have more discussion with all of them, and particularly the one that I have suggested.
Would you please elaborate on what you mean by civic professionalism?
Yes, I mean the kind of professionalism that generates the engineer's outlook towards the broader pictures of engineering, the elements dealing with the society in general. And I think in that category, the question of whether there should be transferable pensions and things of that nature, which transcend the local type questions which the union generally engages in between employer and individual employee relationships.
Well, I don't want to nag you here, but I want to make sure we get this straight, because transferable pensions represents a specific thing. Are there other elements that you would put in here? Are there other elements that you would include in this civic professionalism that you're speaking about?
I think there are a great many. I hesitate to enumerate all of them right now.
Well, would you name a few? Because I would like to get some feeling. And the reason I'm asking the question this specifically is that this particular subject is quite complex, and one has to have a pretty good feeling with just which component, or whether you have several components in mind.
Well, I think the one area that you could put in here is the ethics of engineering practice. For example, what outlook or relationship should there be between engineers and the public, or the business of one engineer examining another engineer's work, business of public safety aspects of engineering, for example. What responsibility does the engineer have to the public in this category, and so on.
Right. Now, I look upon these as somewhat different than the transferable pension, and this is why I was asking the question.
Yes.
The transferable pension is really concerned directly with an economic benefit. To the individual.
What I'm trying to do in that one instance was to classify the kinds of things that our gentleman from the RCA union mentioned as things that local groups cannot handle themselves, which are really not technical things, but are really national problems. That kind of thing, I'll put in that category.
But you're going beyond the economic benefit, because
yes,
certainly ethics and public safety are not per se.
It's not economic, really, but outside the technical.
Okay, fine. Now there are a series of hands over here. Yes, sir.
I wanted to make a few remarks on the article in the latest Spectrum by, I think, Mr. Donald Finn, the manager. It's on the pension plan. One thing I found rather one-sided approach was that he discussed pension plans of various corporations, and then he went on to discuss portable pension plans. Now, portable pension plans, I think, are a little bit better maybe than the corporation plans, where you leave everything behind if you leave voluntarily or otherwise company. But I think even that is not really a solution. I think the only solution to it would be to disengage the employer completely from the pension plan. Just like in the insurance plans, we don't worry about whether our employer will contribute to our insurance, life insurance or health insurance or other insurance that they choose to carry. I think we should have a similar private pension plan and relieve the employer of the burden to carry his to worry about his employees. Pension arrangements, and also at the same time take away the excuse from him, for instance, for employing older employees, older applicants.
You probably are aware, since you referred to the article, that in order to qualify for tax benefits, pension plans must be established and operated by employers. And so
yes.
So that from that standpoint, then one needs a basic change in the law,
yes,
in order to make this possible.
I realize that, and therefore I submit that we should try to, in some way, maybe not to IEEE, but IEEE could at least be consulted, or acting as a consultant. We should in some way try to find a legislator who maybe would sponsor such a law, maybe in exchange for votes, of course.
I guess you got your message across there.
Well, I have already contacted some legislators on some other problems, like the patent rights of that most employers ask you to sign away when you set employment. But then on the other hand, if you look at the benefit of not paying tax on your contribution, I think we would be better off if we paid tax on our income and then paid our private, for our private retirement plan, than we are with most pension plans that exist nowadays.
Well, isn't this possible to do?
Yeah.
Isn't it possible for an individual to engage in a private pension plan if he's willing to forego the tax benefit?
I wouldn't know that.
My impression is that it is.
Yes, but what I'm saying is I can also take private insurance, life and health insurance. What I'm saying is that by doing this amount of self-insurance, and everybody can set aside any amount of money invested in service in those, and that's it. I'm saying is that a group effort would have much better conditions could be obtained than for an individual.
Why is that true?
Well, why is it true that through IEEE I can get better insurance that I can get if I go as a private citizen individual to some insurance company? Isn't that true?
Well, to answer...
It might be true for you, it's not true for me.
My NASA insurance...
It may be of interest to you to know.
Most of these plans, I understand, they're from statistics, and as you know, one sample doesn't make a very good statistic.
It may be of interest to you to know that the IEEE has looked into this matter of whether or not it could provide pension plans on a group basis, and we were advised by the, as a matter of fact, I think that the organization that handles the insurance was one of the organizations consulted. And we were advised that they felt that the individual could do as well as they could do, doing it on a group basis.
I know I tried recently to purchase an annuity plan, and I found out that I could get as much as 4% out of it, less than in a savings account in the bank. Now, maybe I went to the wrong company, I don't know, but this appeared to me to be the usual run of things.
I think that we ought to go on. I think you were next, sir, and then I'll move across and pick up the center section.
I'm James Favell, and I'm the president of the National Association of Government Engineers. And you haven't touched much on associations, and I thought perhaps I could add a little bit to this discussion by telling you just briefly of our position in the engineering field. We are affiliated with the National Federation of Professional Organizations, which represent the professionals in government. And there's any testimony on the Hill or anything, they represent the professional people as professionals. We are not recognized. We are no union. I would like to ask Mr. Ward a little bit about Executive Order 11491, which got away from informal recognition, but it seems to have driven associations perhaps out of the realm of representing professional people in government. We think that associations have a place for professional people. Much of the troubles that arise in a professional field is a lack of communication and lack of people to talk knowledgeable about problems. We think that through association you can get that type of people, and many of the problems can be resolved very informally. And I just thought perhaps that Mr. Chairman, you'd be interested in this sort of middle of the road approach.
Thank you very much. Do you want to comment, Eric?
I don't know what Executive Order 491 is, so that's...
Government unions.
We're in the center section. You, sir.
It seems to me we're getting off the broader subject of society and more into the details of pension plans, which may have been what kicked it off in the first place, but I'd like to keep it on a broader field. I'm registered in Florida, and down there the engineers have banded without any recourse to electrical, electronic, civil, mechanical, etc., and successfully had several court cases turned over, which involved whether engineers are practicing architecture when they design buildings. This, to me, is the type of thing that professional engineers should get involved in more, and I'd like to hear from those more knowledgeable than I am as to why IEEE feels that some organization like NSPE couldn't perform this as well and couldn't do it for them.
There's no view that the NSPE couldn't be effective. As a matter of fact, I have been involved in discussions with the president and the executive secretary of NSPE over the last 4 or 5 months. And when you heard me respond to the gentleman on my left and I said that we were developing various alternatives, these discussions are related to that. And the NSPE and the individual societies, state societies, are set up to do exactly the kind of thing that you referred to in Florida.
And even on a national level?
And on a national level. Sir, you were next, I think. The man down front, excuse me, I'll catch you in just a minute. You, sir.
Since I'm standing about 15 feet closer to the door than you gentlemen are, I'd like to pick you up one at a time and comment very briefly on your remarks. As far as the preciousness of our tax-exempt status, if any organization that represented all of the engineers managed to improve the economic lot of the engineers nearly as much as the lawyers and our friends in the medical profession, I think we could very easily pay the taxes. In fact, I think about a 1% increase in my salary would easily pay my dues going up from $30 a year to $60 a year if our taxes double. Other than that, I can see nothing precious about a non-tax exempt status. In addition, the Medical Association has found a way to sidestep this through a sister corporate organization, which actually does their lobbying for them, and I don't know the exact structure, but it's certainly something that could be looked into. As regards the engineer in government, that gentleman's a little bit bigger, and I'll just say I agree with everything you said. I think the engineers should be much more active politically and should espouse many of the causes that they're sidestepping and leaving to people that are basically politically orientated, are very, good-hearted, but do not have the technical expertise to answer many of the questions. I'd like to skip, Mr. Mulligan, just for a minute, reserve my most vituperous remarks for the end. as far as Mr. Ammon's position, in the late 1950s and early 1960s, I stood on the opposite side of the fence from an engineering union and managed to win an argument and decertify the union. This does not mean that I am not in favor of unions. I think they serve a very valuable purpose in our economy. One of the primary reasons for not espousing the organized collective bargaining unit as a way for the engineers to solve all the problems of the world is, A, most of the engineers have a repugnance for it. It comes out over and over again in surveys. I can't explain this. It's wrapped up in the charisma of professionalism, but they're opposed to it. Secondly, if we are truly professionals, we maintain our professional status when we cross that magic line from hiring and not hiring people. And any organization that professes to represent all the professionals in it, but excludes those people who have become employers now, supervisors, is excluding a very valuable segment of that profession. Now, as regards the comments on Bar Association, I was intrigued by that because it showed that there are three elements that are useful to engineers in a technical society, in a society. One is an organization will bring together the various technical knowledges that the engineers wish to exchange with one another. This is what the IEEE does now. The other two facets goes beyond the strictly technical matters and involves itself with, one, the professional's own standards, the standards of employment, the legal standards for a person to justify his existence. Secondly, that group lobbies, and it does lobbying both for good public works, but also, very frankly, it lobbies in order to preserve their own security, their financial security. Both the AMA and the Bar Association can control their membership and, in large extent, can control their members' incomes because they set the standards for entrance to that profession, they control it, and they do this through a law. Now, to get back to the center, Mr. Mulligan is bigger, and I'm keeping my eye on the stairs here, but I really don't think the IEEE has done a hell of a lot to find out what the members want. I'm very appreciative of this meeting now, and I hope there'll be many more of them. But I could show you, I won't, but if you insist, I brought two surveys that I picked out just in the last month from the freebie journals, you know, the sort of junk journals. Every one of them that you read is now running a poll. It's no secret why, because the engineers are getting into dire economic straits. What do these polls show? That the engineers crave some organization that will bring together both the technical aspects of their profession and the economic aspects, the civic aspects. Why has the IEEE, with a much larger readership than any of these organizations, Industrial Research is one, ED is another, why have they not run a survey like this? These meetings are very good because you get a very personal flavor of what people want, but it would be certainly very simple for the IEEE, which employs some very excellent statistician or has them on their volunteer board, to put together a survey and find out what 150,000 people want. That comprises about 1/6 of the total professional population of the United States. The American Mechanical Association has done this, the Chemical Society has done this, and I think it's inexcusable that the IEEE has not done this. I sincerely hope, Mr. Mulligan, that we will do this in the near future.
What do you know when you find that out?
We find out, for example, that according to the Industrial Research Survey, which surveyed some 2,700 people, that 80% of the engineers responding to that survey did in fact want an organization that would represent them. I'll add to the list of things you were compiling. One, salary statistics throughout the country. An engineer is very proud of his ability to bargain for himself. But how does he do it when he really doesn't know what the guy that's working 10 miles down the street is making, much less that's working 200 or 2,000 miles away? This would be a very valuable feature. Why stop concerning ourselves with a pension? When you leave a company that's employing you, you're losing all of the fringe benefits. Fringe benefits which you're not free to lightly dismiss. Because if you drop your medical payments and you've got a three-month period, your medical insurance is, and you've got a three-month period before you can get insurance in the next company, you're suffering an economic loss either because you're uninsured or you pay the private membership dues. The IEEE has an excellent medical plan now. There are excellent private pension plans. But as I'm sure Mr. Ammon could point out, every time he's negotiated a contract, the company has foregone an increase in salary to people to give you this in fringe benefits. If you don't take advantage of this, you're throwing bucks away. But the only way we can take advantage of these plans right now is to take the company's plan that's offered. They're excellent plans as long as you're employed by that company.
One of the company's reasons for doing that, though, is encouraging you to stay with the company, and that's why they want you to pay some of these costs.
If the company could assure me of that employment, I happen to be a manager at a company, so I'm really representing both points of the view. If the company could assure me of that employment or any other person, that would be valid. Right now, however, the companies are underpaying into pension plans by a very substantial amount.
What's the right amount?
Let me just finish that remark so you'll understand what I mean. When I say they're underpaying into it, I mean that companies are putting into a pension plan monies far in excess of what people will in effect draw out of that plan. Because when people leave that pension plan, unless they have complete vesting rights, and they've acquired those vesting rights, that money that's put into that pension plan by the company stays with that plan. As a result, that plan is really not paying for itself. Now, something's going to have to give here, obviously. You can't make money out of nothing. The reason why the blue-collar workers are making the salary they're making now, and the reason why the other professionals that are organized in a different way are making the money they're making now, is that they can exert some economic influence on their employers, and secondly, they have a very good image with the public. As engineers, we have almost no image with the public. We're a creature that makes something, that can shoot off to the moon, that builds a bridge, but no one looks at an engineer and says, yeah, that's a man that's worth $20,000, $30,000 a year. It's a supply and demand situation. Until the engineers demand, the money is not going to be supplied.
I'd love to debate that, but it's my opinion that the lawyers for many years have had no pension plan. They've done pretty well. I mean, the law firms typically don't do that, and doctors, acting as individuals, typically don't have pension plans, and they survive.
Acting as an individual, they can regulate their income. Acting as an individual that's employed, my income is tied to what the employer will give. If the employer is presently giving me a part of my income as his contribution to the pension plan, and I walk away from that because he has no work for me any longer, or I voluntarily choose to go, I've left a part of my income behind. When you're a lawyer or when you're a doctor and you make $100 in a particular period of time and you walk away from that office to another, you walk away with that $100 in your bank. I can't take the money that's left behind me in the company bank. But I don't want to get hung up on this pension because it's not the most important thing. I think engineers are screaming for and are demanding many other things than the pension. Now, to say that the NSPE could provide it, it is an excellent idea, but the National Society of Professional Engineers represent a very tiny fragment of the engineering population. I was the chairman approximately 10 years ago of a movement that was before its time, or maybe will never come a morning, called the Functional Society for Engineers in Industry, where we as employed engineers tried to interest the professional engineers in espousing the cause of the employed engineers.
Well, look, let's just mention another point of view, just simply to give you something to think about.
I'll yield the floor because I've made my point.
Okay, but let me just take that point and say it this way. It may very well be that because the government needed engineering work done more rapidly than the society could supply it, that it raised the level of salaries faster than it intrinsically should have. And maybe all engineering salaries have been accelerated too rapidly. There's another point of view to this.
I worked my way through college as a plumber. It's an excellent trade. Had I stayed with it, I would have been making just slightly more than I'm making now. I think that intrinsically a plumber, and I have many friends still in the plumbing profession, I think they do excellent work, but frankly, I want to get paid more money. So I don't think the engineer salaries are going up too fast. They're not going up fast enough because it is a law of supply and demand, and unless you demand it, it's not going to be supplied to you. It's as simple as that.
Wait a minute. That isn't the normal law of supply.
The members of the panel have asked for equal time, and I'll start over at the left. My equal time is going to be very short. You did not hear me make any reference to tax status as it being sacrosanct or having any basis for decision making, and I might say that that is an open question. Now, those members of the panel that want to answer some of the questions, we'll give them an opportunity.
I would like to comment on, I agree with all. A good bit of many things you said. As far as the tax status thing, that puzzles me anyhow. I think the Society of Professional Engineers lobbied, because I've lobbied with them on that pension legislation. Our organization is, my dues to the organization are deductible to me because it's a business expense, just like your dues are. And I don't think that that is a controlling factor, which is what you said, as to what your activities are. In the pension plan field, although it was commented on by one of the panel that the doctors and lawyers didn't have it and they did all right, the trend now, because industry is so pension-minded and because of bargaining, if you want not only the young lawyer to go to work for you in the large firms, but if you want to keep your secretaries, we've found that particularly in places like Washington and New York, where you the bank downstairs in the building you practice in, they provide all those people with a pension. It might not be much good, but the secretary upstairs knows that too. So that the trend is really going to be over the next few years some type of retirement plan, and it's been bubbling for a long time, because what makes it bubble is the lawyer that leaves his practice to go to work as a general counsel of ABC company. And his former partner never does quite retire. He's 75 years old, and he hadn't quite retired. Well, now, he might have had good income, but with the taxes the way they are, there wasn't anything left, unless he invested it right. This guy's retired at 65 years old, and he's playing golf. Now, that's the reason we have some very high-income lawyers take federal judgeships. They couldn't possibly save that much money to retire on what a federal judge can retire on, full pay. At 70. But I think that a number of the things that you mentioned, and it was mentioned back there about sort of civic responsibility and getting and technical, I think we sort of backed into the technical after we sort of did the reverse. We didn't do much in legal education of attorneys until the past few years. In other words, institutes, publications. We sort of went the other way around.
Yes, I think I'd enjoy it. Looking at the development of the professional unions, I noted for you earlier that the organizations that have existed started about 1945, when there was a great drive by industrial type unions to bring into their ranks the professionals. Thus, they formed their own guilds or associations. For many years, the supply and demand theory, I've alluded to this so many times, that there weren't one strike in among engineers. There were literally hundreds of thousands, because from the period about 1945 through the mid-60s, any engineer in the United States that was dissatisfied with the terms and conditions of his employment did a very simple thing. He put his resume in the hands of a placement agency, and moved on to the next company and picked up his 10% and got his drapes paid for and got all of the moving costs taken care of. So there were no strikes, per se, but there was plenty of mobility. And the engineering community at large was a young community, and they weren't concerned about pensions. They weren't concerned about health and welfare. But engineers are concerned about it today, because how many engineers do you think are retiring today or reaching the age of retirement and have absolutely no pension programs because they've worked for 14 employers in the last 10 years? So these are growing problems. Today, the industrially employed engineer is looking around and he's asking some basic questions. What am I going to do about it? He no longer can leave his place of employment and go on to the next company and find a 10% increase and leave behind what he might have termed an unprofessional work atmosphere. Now he has to stay. For instance, North American Rockwell, about a year ago, initiated a new wage plan, which was in effect a very substantial reduction in wages. Like you take the first $800 of your income on a monthly basis, subtract that from the monthly income, and then take half of the remainder. So using an example, $1,500 a month engineer would take 800, subtract that from the 15, gives him 700, divide that in half, it's 350, his new wages were 1150. He wasn't too concerned until that happened. As of this afternoon at 4 o'clock in the NLRB region in Los Angeles, the case closed on 10,000 engineers seeking to establish a union at North American Rockwell. Now, when we start to identify problems, our laws, the laws applicable in this country, state very clearly that if an organization is going to represent the interests of a community, it must be certified. If it's not, today it's illegal. This is in reference to the executive order. There's no more informal. I wouldn't hesitate to say that even sounding boards today are illegal. Now, if there are problems on the local level and the professional wants to bring in professional standards, he can't leave. He was not professional all during the 40s, the 50s, and 60s when he did leave. If he's going to correct those problems, and I really could care less whether he calls it a union, a guild, an association, or whatever, but he has to operate under the appropriate law. And the appropriate law says that either through voluntary recognition and or National Labor Relations Board certification, that group is certified to bargain for those engineers. And for IEEE or NSP or any other group to establish a code of ethics, to establish a standard, and then walk into an employer and say, you're not meeting these standards, we're going to blackball you, you'll get sued. Because who are you to set standards for any company? Now, if you're talking of those items affecting your career, if you're talking about enacting legislation to prevent the employer community from having you sign a contract that says anything that you invent belongs to the company, you're going to do it, as Eric has indicated, on a political level, which you are not accustomed to doing. If you're going to establish portable pensions in industry, which is absolutely contrary to why pension programs were established by industry, to keep employees so that they would be there at age 65. With you people, it's a very simple thing. I need you so long as I have the contract. Once you have produced the product, out the door. I don't need you. And that's what management's saying to you. Now, unless you recognize what your organization can do and the limitations placed on it by law, and unless you truly start to understand this field of industrial and labor relations and political, gentlemen, you're going to stay as confused as you are.
And this poor.
And what, sir? I missed it.
And this poor.
I completely agree with you.
Eric, you want to say anything? Chairman, you want to make any comment?
Yeah, I think I'd better make some comments. We are not alone in this. A survey by Blum and Funkhauser in 1967 indicated that most legislators had not sought and would not seek the advice of psychologists or psychiatrists on changes in sex and drug laws. We're not alone in this. The psychologists have exactly the same problems of getting to their legislators. As a matter of fact, I was thinking this evening that I ought to resign from the taxpayers group because I, as a taxpayer, hadn't been able to make very much of an impression on my legislator. And we ought to have some pressure group, some strong group, that can make an impression on the legislators. But we're not going to do it by any technical, we're not going to do it by any logical presentation. We're going to do it by getting out to the polls, by making our contributions to the candidates, and by getting to those candidates every day and telling them that they won't get our vote or anybody else's vote that we can influence unless they legislate the things that we would like to have them legislate. And we're going to do it as individuals. We're not going to do it as an association. Our institute is not big enough to do it. We can join with all of the other institutes in the NSPE or any other group that we want, and we can have a legislative group that will have some pressure. But as individuals, we can do much more, very much more. Now, I'd like to point out also that invention is not confined in our discipline to inventions in the electrical or electronic field. We are entitled and we are capable of making inventions in the social and in the economic and in the political field because we have the ability to invent. And if you have demonstrated that ability to invent in the technical field, then study the political, the economic, and the social and the psychological fields, and you will be able to invent in those fields also because you are innovators. But innovators are not confined to their field. As a matter of fact, more and more, we are finding that interdiscipline inventions become of great importance. I first had an experience in this when I was in graduate school, and one of the courses that I was compelled to take was a course in chemistry. And because I wasn't very good in chemistry, I chose the least onerous of the courses, a course in physical chemistry. And I liked the professor very much. And I got him acquainted with Professor Dennison in the physics department, and the first thing I knew, those two guys were writing joint papers together, and they're some of the finest technical contributions that have been made in the field of physics and physical chemistry. In the same way, you'll find Dr. Harold writing editorials in Spectrum, all of which all of you have castigated this evening. But Dr. Harold has pointed out that we have very much in common with a psychologist, and we have great contributions that we can make in the psychological field. There is no instrumentation to determine whether an individual is sane or insane, or to keep track of him to determine when he is sane and when he is not sane. We can provide that instrumentation through our ingenuity in the same way that we have provided instrumentation for the medical profession in the past. But it's an entirely new field for us to get into. Dr. Goldseer, who developed the first practical oral contraceptive, did it because he was able to persuade a physicist to produce for him an automatic recording ultraviolet fluorescent spectrophotometer so that he could measure the ingredients of the spermatic fluid and determine which of those ingredients determined whether that spermatic fluid was going to be viable or not. Now, those are the sorts of inventions, interdiscipline, that we can make, and we can make them in this field of portable pensions, in this field of labor relations, in any of the other fields, because we have the ingenious people in our institute.
I'd like to get back to the sequence of questioning. I'm still working the middle section. You, sir, and then you, and then we'll move to the left hand.
I would like to make a statement about the kind of organization we're talking about. I'd like to say that I think this organization should be called the American Engineering Association or the American Scientific Association. Either of those names, though, of course, implies that there are engineers of other breeds than electrical. Consequently, I would say that we should forget about IEEE and its association with this. I think that maybe this could be verified by a representative from Barr that the Americans Association of Medical Association and the Bar Association both started out with an objective in mind, an
and created a new organization. I don't think they modified an old organization. And that's what I propose we do, to start a new organization, and start it tonight.
Sir?
We've had a good lesson on civics. Gentlemen there, board, taught us to make our voice felt, write to our congressmen, and exert pressure. Well, this is very nice, and it's theoretically very sound, and it's practice of democracy at its best. But unfortunately, it doesn't work too well, because a lot of people, and engineers particularly, are not very good at it. They're not very good at it by the same reason that make them good at their work. They are introverts. They don't want to get too involved with people. They are not very good at the art of politics, of exerting pressure. They don't like doing it, the question of ethics, of professionalism, if you like. So that is a very serious problem. And this is why it seems to me engineers, on the whole, are looking for leadership. They're looking for leadership in the government, because government is a two-way affair. It's all right to go and vote and exert pressure, but every citizen, engineers or not, is expecting leadership from the government, whether it's local, state, or national. So we, I think, whether we admit it or not, I think there's a lot of anxiety in the engineering community, which is a reflection of anxiety in the country as a whole. Be that as it may, we are looking for leadership. And that leadership will have to be provided by somebody, because there's always comes, for those who like to learn from the lessons of history, when the time is right, the man or the organization come forward to do it. Now, this leadership can be provided by federal government, can be provided by the IEEE, can be provided by the union movement, can be provided by an association that we might decide to form. But it's going to come, because this is what we want. And I think this is the main point that I wanted to stress. It's not so much sit there and ask people, what do you want? Five parts of this or three parts of that, or what do you people want? I think you all know what we want, or you will be here the first day. The question is, what do you have to offer us? What do you have to give us individually, collectively? What do you have to give the nation in terms of what the technology is going to look like in a few years? What we have to give the young people in high school today who are thinking maybe about taking scientific courses and might look at their neighbors who were father of neighbors, went out of work, age 54, 20 years experience, pension plan, the whole thing. So that's not for me. What is, and I think the government is there to answer this question, what kind of policy is evolving to make sure that there's going to be enough engineers in 5 to 10 years to solve all the problems that we hear everybody every day about, including the one about the psychologists, if you believe in it. That's all.
Do you want to comment?
Yeah. First of all, I think speaking from the government's point of view, I'm not sure there's any centralized policy that is ever directed at the kind of question that you're asking. Because the employment of engineers is actually the effect of the missions of a number of agencies that are entirely independent of each other, with nobody looking across that whole problem, nobody with the power to shift funds from one to the other, even if they did look across it. And so what we have is an engineering employment that's based on the amount of dollars we spend on research and development to some close approximation. And that number is the summation of a bunch of individual budgets that were not made with any broad perspective across this, probably can't be, in our incremental appropriations process that we now put the budget together with. So what you're asking for, I don't think, is possible within the governmental structure. Now, the thing that is possible is if the economic conditions remain strong, then the total number of jobs will be sufficient to employ the total engineering population. It may not be sufficient to employ them all in Newport Beach or in Seattle, Washington, but it may be sufficient to employ, at least the jobs are there. You may not want to live in Kansas, but that may be where the job is. That situation exists now, in fact. Our guesses are that we have about 65,000 to 75,000 unemployed scientists and engineers as a result of aerospace and defense cutbacks. That number will increase in the next 6 months, that there probably are enough jobs nationally to absorb that volume of people, maybe not at the same salary level, and for sure not in the same markets, not in the same geographical location. But if in fact the total number of jobs is decreased because of economic conditions, then no amount of redistribution is going to solve that. And so in effect what you must do is solve the economic problem first, get the economy going in an upward bent, or the jobs aren't going to be there. Now I'd ask you one more question. If at the government expense people gain an education, does the government have an obligation to those people to guarantee them a job in that field?
I would just like to check up here on my boss. You said between 9:30 and quarter of 10, and I can run a tight meeting. Is it quarter of 10 that you want to end it? Is that what you want? All right, then I'd like to get to these fellows over here that have been awfully patient before we have any further responses. Let me start at the top and go right across. You, sir.
A good portion of the discussion so far has dealt with exactly what problems we are talking with. I would like to present a question concerning who, because here we are talking about people who work for organizations that may involve 1,000, 2,000, 10,000 engineers, but we're also talking about the same sort of people who work for organizations that may only employ 1, 2, or 3 engineers. And that organization, those people working in the 1, 2, and 3 category may be just as much in need of the same sort of help that the person who's working with 5 or 10,000 engineers is concerned with. The questions are the same as far as affordable pension are concerned, as far as their relation with their management of the company that they work for, their rights, either as a regular employee or as an exempt employee in a professional status. So the questions are the same. So I'm wondering if any thought has been given to this aspect of the problem with respect to what sort of solutions might be arrived at.
Does anyone on the panel want to respond to this?
Well, the only thing I can use as an example, I left RCA's Moorestown facilities Friday afternoon, and there were a group of leaders and managers that were leaving the building at the same time. Fortunately, it was after 5 o'clock. And their comments were, thanks a lot for the general increase we just received. In our experience, we negotiate a contract for some 1,200 people, but we know it affects 6,000 or 7,000 people, because it affects all of RCA, affects all of management. So in effect, if solutions are going to come forth from whatever direction, it will not only affect the mass concentration of engineers, it will have a byproduct and a byplay for other engineers. In other words, and the segment that I'm speaking for is the industrially employed. We've heard Boeing on the West Coast, they employ now 8,000 instead of the 14,000 they employed 2 years ago, but they still have 8,000. McDonnell Douglas, Lockheed, RCA. For instance, our area alone, we've sustained from 1961 through today, we've sustained a 50% loss. We had a top of some 2,500 engineers. We're now back to 1,200. We were down to as low as 1,000. All I can say is anything that is done will, of course, for instance, if a portable pension program through IEEE, NSPE, the Council of Engineers and Scientists should ever come about, it's going to affect all engineers. So at least if we're moving towards some solutions, I really could care less who does it, whether it's IEEE, NSPE, the union movement, or whatever. As long as a result is received and it's beneficial to the community, then we will feel we've accomplished something.
You want to comment in there?
Well, I just simply say this. I ran a company once, and we ran an experiment. We asked our employees, would you rather have this pension plan or would you rather have the money? And 100% of them wanted the money. Nobody wanted the pension plan. Give us the money, we'll spend it ourselves, we can take care of ourselves, and we will take care of ourselves, you give it to us. So that brings up an interesting question as to whether society really, in fact, has the right to force on somebody a system they don't really want when they'd really rather have the money. And given that choice, by the way, almost everybody will take the money. Regardless of the fact they may not invest it, when they're 65, they're damn sorry they didn't. But in fact, given that free choice, there wasn't anybody who said, give us a pension plan. Everybody said, give us the money, we'll do with it what we want to do with it. So I bring that up merely because this pension argument Sounds to me a little like a something-for-nothing kind of an argument, which in fact I'm sure it really isn't. But I do think an individual can, if he wants to, get every bit as good a pension, plus or minus a few percent, as an individual as he can collectively. In many cases, I think that's true.
You, sir?
It seems to me, you've heard a lot of reasons tonight why we can't do something.